have the, Shoftim is about the failure to perform a possible task, right? They were supposed to, follow up on Yehoshua's footsteps, which should have been doable. And that's a total catastrophe. The central question, which I think I heard Greg Blank ask last week, which was, we're in an era of miracles. So, how are people not having the faith we'd want? And second of all, what lessons can we draw from this whole era in Jewish history? Right? It's the era, there are prophets, miracles, saviors, and yet they're still failing. So I think the first thing we need to realize on a major macro level is, what are the contributing factors to the failure of faith of the people before we dig into any of the leaders, any of the judges? I'll just ask if everyone can, I don't want to mute everybody because I want people to be able to jump in, but if everyone could just take a second to mute themselves. And then if anybody wants to make a comment, which I definitely, we want, don't hesitate to unmute and jump in. Okay. So I think we can identify four specific points that contribute to the failure of faith that B'nai Israel have during the period of the Shoftim. The first one really flows from the book of Yehoshua. The book of Yehoshua was the transition from the era of nature-defying miracles to the era where B'nai Israel are living under natural existence with divine providence. And if we remember, over the course of the battles of Yehoshua, the miracles became less and less obvious, and by the end they seem to have disappeared entirely. Yehoshua fights against Jericho, that's the first battle, and they don't do a thing, right? They just blow the shofar and the walls miraculously collapse. By the end of the battles, when they're fighting the kings in the north, the wars go on for years and years and there are no open miracles at all. So the truth is, first of all, you don't have the same miraculous existence.
Is that real or that's a fake?
No, that would be a fake background.
I don't know who that is.
Get those fake backgrounds.
Lois, you did mute, but then you unmuted. So.
Oh, okay.
Just so you know.
It says mute, yeah.
It
has to have a red line.
You have to have a red line.
Brandon, this would be great if we could use this all the time to mute people.
You're not kidding.
No, but they refuse to mute themselves, so it doesn't help.
Okay, so I'm just kind of like...
Thanks, Rana, yeah.
Oh, you're okay. Back. Good.
When you push a mute, and then it says unmute. So
I'm on... Okay, I'm on my wife's mobile hotspot, so this is how we'll work things out from there. Going forward, I apologize for the internet problems. Okay, so piece number one in Shoftim, right, is that the truth is we do not have the same type of open miracles that we had in Yehoshua. One example that actually brings this out very dramatically, if we think to last week's learning, is what was the miracle of Devorah? Devorah HaNeviyah, right? She's, in a lot of ways, the best of the Shoftim. It's the easiest success of the Shoftim, maybe. What was the miracle in her victory? The truth is, it's obliquely referenced in Devorah's song in chapter 5. In the narration of the actual battle in chapter 4, it doesn't appear at all. The existence of miracles is not only is it not pivotal in the story seems to go out of its way to not put that in center stage, because something amazing happened with the river Kishon over there, whether it flooded or there was a sudden rainstorm that made it impossible for Sisera's chariots to operate. Something happened. The Navi doesn't think it's a big deal for us to understand that. And part of that is because we do not have open miracles in the way we had under Moshe in the desert. And as that happens for generation after generation, that can be something that causes a spiritual problem for the people. Okay. point number two, which leads to a crisis in faith, is something that the Navi highlighted in the beginning of the book, and then we see the consequences as it goes on, which is that Bnei Israel are not as vigorous as they should have been in terms of mopping up the conquest and clearing out the Canaanim from the various places where they retained a presence. Again, that reared its head in the Devorah and Sisera story, because the Canaanim collect in Emek Yisrael, right, the valley to the north of the Shomron. And that them remaining there, you know, that influence again leads to a deterioration of faith in the people. That's going to be something that comes out very clearly in the Avimelech story. And if we think to the end of the book, where the end of the book is gonna lead us, we're gonna see Bnei Israel basically transform into Sodom, right? The whole story of the Pilegesh in Giva, where there's they take route, there's rape, there's murder, there's civil war. The end of the book, the Jews are like Sodom. Sodom is, you know, kind of the epitome of Canaan. So Canaan is still there, and that's just a corrosive influence on the people. That's point number two. Point number three is you can have a negative feedback loop where you have a failure to fully conquer the land, as the book pointed to in the beginning. And then that can lead to problems of faith, right? Because, well, if Hashem was behind us, we would have fully conquered the land. So we don't fully conquer the land. That can lead to problems of faith. Problems of faith can then lead to further problems, right? Because the Jews aren't behaving like they're supposed to, so Hashem doesn't have their back. And then that only leads to further problems. So the original, you know, the original sin of not getting the Canaanim out of the land, besides the fact that now they're there and that's a corrosive problem, that just triggers a negative feedback loop where Bnei Israel are less and less successful over the course of the book. And being less and less successful means that they're going to have less and less faith. And the fourth problem that you have, besides the fact that you have to just deal with the reality where there are no miracles, and you have the Canaanim still there, you didn't get them out, and you have this negative feedback loop. So the fourth problem is one of leadership. First three are on the people. The fourth one is on leadership. And particularly, those who are supposed to lead do not do so. So if we had to think, who are the Shvatim, who are the tribes that are charged with leadership? So who would come to mind?
Yehuda.
Number one is Yehuda, right? We need two more on the list. Yehuda is one.
Reuven.
So Reuven was supposed to be, right? But he already failed back in Brachus, and he got fired.
Binyamin.
So we kind of think so, because like we like Binyamin, but he's never put in a leadership position per se until Shaul comes along, right? But Binyamin was not one of the primary tribes.
It's Menashe.
Menashe.
Yeah, so in Shoftim, Menashe plays a large role, which is surprising, because which of Yosef's two sons is supposed to be the prominent one?
Ephraim,
right? Yehuda is one prominent Shevet. Ephraim is supposed to be another one. And what's the third prominent Shevet? We have in the Chumash, they jump out in their leadership.
Levi.
Someone said Levi, right? And again, if everyone can mute, if you're not talking, that would be great. And then unmute when you jump in. Levi is number three, the spiritual leadership of the people. Those are the three tribes that who are supposed to lead: Levi, Ephraim, and Yehuda. If we think about the trajectory of Sefer Shoftim, those tribes do not show up. The prominent Shvatim, the Shoftim, by and large, are from elsewhere. The beginning of Jewish history in Eretz Yisrael, you have Yehoshua from Shevet Ephraim, right? His number two in the whole book is Elazar, Aaron's son, the Kohen Gadol, from the tribe of Levi. Pinchas is active, right? So you have Levi is active in the time of Yehoshua. And you have Kalev from Shevet Yehuda, and then Kalev's brother, Asniel, we have in the beginning of Shoftim. Everything is great. Yehuda, Ephraim, and Levi are active in the beginning of the era of the conquest of the land. As Shoftim goes on, we see these three tribes either not show up, or we'll see a pattern where when they do show up, invariably their behavior is disappointing, right? So the example we'll have from Gidon this week is going to be that Ephraim, you know, shows up late to the war and wants to start a civil war, right? And that behavior is going to come up again and again. And especially when we get to the end of the book, because at the end of the book, when the failure is really climax, pay careful attention to this, to the roles of the tribes of Yehuda, Ephraim, and Levi. Those who are supposed to be leading are not doing so. So those are four main problems that we've got, right? We're struggling to deal with a new reality where we don't have open miracles. We have just a failure in, you know, they're being lazy in the conquest and the Canaanim are around and are corroding the people's influence. You have this negative feedback loop. They're not conquering the land that's causing them to lose faith. And the fourth problem is the problem of leadership. Leadership is not the entire problem that people have, right? We read Shoftim and like by default, we might think we should first look at the leadership because that always, you know, gets our primary attention. Let's look at the leaders and see how good or poorly they're doing. That's part of the story, not the whole thing, right? We got to focus on the people as well. Okay, so that's like basic introduction, you know, perspective to have on the book of Shoftim. What is causing the crisis of faith among the people? One more just, you know, basic thing that I want to get on the record. I think it's very helpful to keep in mind as we are all learning the book and making our way through it, is we're going to see over the course of the book a big transition in terms of the nature of the enemies that Bnei Yisrael face. Basically, the first half of the book, the enemies that we face are a bunch of mediocre, small-time foes that under normal circumstances should not oppose a strategic threat to Bnei Yisrael at all. So Gidon, this, what we're learning this week is going to be the best example. Midian. Who is Midian? Yeah, Midian's like these desert, you know, raiders who run around, you know, like on the top of the Arabian Peninsula. That, under normal circumstances, should not pose any strategic threat to Bnei Yisrael whatsoever. You know, think back to previous weeks, Moab, right? Moab bothers Bnei Yisrael in the time of Ehud. Moab are small timers who are living on the other side of the Jordan River, right? During the time of the kings, they are under imperial domination. The way it's supposed to work, you know, from David onwards, is the Jews are supposed to be bossing around Moab and not the other way, not the other way around, right? The Canaanim, who we dealt with last week, it was this remnant of Canaan. You know, Yehoshua shattered their overall power, but this remnant of Canaan somehow, you know, scrapes it together and overpowers Bnei Israel.
How about the Plishtim? They were a big regional force.
Very good. Exactly. So in the first half of Shoftim, the enemies that we have are enemies who, without divine intervention, should not have posed any threat at all, right? Under normal circumstances, Midian should not be an overpowering military threat to Bnei Israel. Moab should not be an overpowering military threat to Bnei Israel. Canaanite remnants should not be an overpowering threat to Bnei Israel. And sure enough, after the Shofet saves us from each one of these, they never cause us a serious problem ever again, right?
The Plishtim showed up later.
Exactly. So very good. So we don't take the warnings to heart, right? And so over the course of Shoftim, the enemies become more and more dangerous. Yiftach is going to deal with Ammon, and Ammon is going to be a problem going forward in Jewish history. David is going to fight long wars against Ammon. Shaul is going to fight a war against Ammon, who's going to be aggressive. That's going to be a bigger enemy, a more dangerous threat, as we get worse and worse. And then, as Bernie, I think, and Elliot also said, when we get to Shimshon, now the whole strategic map changes. Because, and this is kind of, you know, between the lines, is while we were coming in with Yehoshua, right, we're coming into the Jordan River, and we're taking over the central part of the country. We're taking over Yehuda, Shomron, Har Ephraim, the Galil. At the same time, you have this group, and they seem from secular historians think this as well. It comes out of some Sukkim as well. And those of us who we did some classes on this last year, actually. You have the Plishtim, which are invading from the Greek island. And the Plishtim are a totally different story. The Plishtim are a well-armed, well-run, aggressive military power, and they are going to pose a real strategic threat to Bnei Israel for generations. That kind of enemy is something that we don't think in the beginning of the Shoftim. We have enemies which really should have been pretty manageable, right? We're not good when, you know, when the opportunities were easy. So at the end of the book, the opportunity is going to be hard, and you're going to have the Plishtim, and Shimshon is going to deal with them, and he's going to fail, and then Shmuel has to deal with them, and Shaul has to deal with them, and David has to deal with them, and they're still around even after that. So that's something also to just have in mind, what the national strategic picture looks like for Bnei Israel during this time period. At the beginning, it was an opportune moment to take over the whole country, settle it, and be peaceful. We don't take advantage. Things get worse and worse. And then by the end of the book, we have real serious enemies to face. Okay, so with that introduction overall out of the way, now let's dig into Gidon. If we're going to do this, you know, like as a regular course in Shoftim, where we weren't doing, you know, just like the whole book in a month. So I would love to give two different shiurim on Gidon, one on Gidon the good guy, and then one on Gidon the bad guy, and then try to rectify the two. So we're gonna, you know, collapse this all into one shiur, because Gidon is definitely the most, I think, the most complicated of the Shoftim. I think he's also the most important of the Shoftim. In some ways, he's also the greatest of the Shoftim. What do I mean by that? By the greatest of the Shoftim. So he's certainly not the best. He's not the most faithful. He's not the simplest, right? If we the three previous ones we've had, we're looking at the instruction, Otniel, Ehud, and then Dvorah, are all pretty simple, straightforward, good guys, we could say, right? There's no clear flaw that Dvorah has, right? Dvorah, you know, leads the people, they win a war, Baruch Hashem, right? Ehud, right? He's very brave, takes on Eglon, they win a war, Baruch Hashem, everything's good. Gidon, first one, who's a complicated person. And yet, on the other hand, the victory that he pulls off against Midian seems to be the one that Bnei Israel remember more than any other in Shoftim. Because you look in Tehillim, and you look in Sefer Yeshayahu, and it is Gidon's victory that is being brought up again and again, I think like three or four different times in Yeshayahu or in Tehillim. So Gidon's accomplishments in a lot of ways are seen as greater as his predecessors, even though he himself is a more complicated personality. So what we're going to do is, you know, just try to shed some light on who he is and why I think he's really the most relevant of the Shoftim and also the most important of the Shoftim. So before we look at him at all, the first thing you notice, if you just look at, you know, I put down this list of seven judges on the top of the sheet. So you see, he's literally the turning point, right? We have seven main judges. There are a bunch of minor ones, but these are the ones who really are prominently discussed in the book of Shoftim. You have the first three, which are great, easy, everything's nice, right? You have the last three, Avimelech, Yiftach, and Shimshon, who range from, you know, mediocre at best to disastrous at worst, right? So you have this major turning point. And then Gidon is in the middle. So he's the turning point of the book. He's the central judge. He's also the one who's really talked about. I don't see the list. Okay, it's good to know. I don't see the sheet anymore. Okay. Sheet now available again?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, thanks. So he's the turning point judge. He's the one who his whole life is described, right? We meet him in the beginning, we track his career. He seems to be the Shofate who is, you know, focused on the most. Now, there's this amazing source in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which we have to see when we talk about Gidon. The Yerushalmi is referencing the message that Shmuel is going to have to the people, right? The The people want a king. Shmuel is unhappy. He gives him a king. And then Shmuel, right, he has his retirement speech where he, you know, rips Bnei Yisrael for just being really not good. It's going to be the Haftorah for Korach, right? So if you pay attention to that in a few weeks, that's going to be over here. So Shmuel talks about, you know, how good God was to the Jews. You know, he gave them Moshe, he gave them Aaron, and then Shmuel continues. He says, he gave you Yerubaal, that's Gidon. He gave you Bedan, which Chazal think means Shimshon, right? The son of Sheva Dan. He gave you Yiftach, and he gave you Shmuel. So we have these six people, Moshe, Aaron, Gidon, Shimshon, Yiftach, and Shmuel. So the Gemara says an amazing line. It says, why are we comparing Moshe, Aaron, and Shmuel to Yiftach, Shimshon, and Gidon? So the Gemara says, Hikish Shlosha Kalei Olam, Lishlosha Abirei Olam. Right? Shmuel linked the three lightweights of the world to the three giants of the world. Right? Olam Dachasha, Beit Dino, Shel Gidon, Shel Yiftach, Shel Shimshon, Shekulin, etc. To teach you that the leadership of the three lightweights is equal to those of the heavyweights, right? Which the line, as it's put in the Bavli, is more well-known. Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro, right? You only have whoever you have in your generation. And, you know, you're kind of stuck with the leader that you've got. But you have this line in the Gemara, which, you know, compares Gidon not to the greats, right? Not to Moshe and Aaron and Shmuel. Compares him to Yiftach and Shimshon, to the real mediocrities. So that's taking a real surprising perspective, a real dark perspective on Shimshon. Karbon Ha'eda explains, you know, we're just wondering why Shmuel didn't mention some of the other better ones. Like he could have mentioned Yehoshua, could have mentioned Devorah or Ehud, right? Basically, Shmuel seems to have picked out what he thought were the most mediocre of the Shoftim. On the other hand, right, here's just one example of a verse in Yeshayahu where Yeshayahu, you know, hundreds of years later, is, you know, recalling the victory of Gidon over Midian, and he's comparing it to the victory of Egypt, right? And you have this amazing amazing legacy. So you have this real tension. Is Gidon the one, like Shmuel is remembering, that Gidon is associated with Yiftach and Shimshon, or like Yeshayahu is remembering, that Gidon is being associated with Moshe and Aaron? So this tension extends in a really amazing way if we look at some deliberate parallels that the Navi draws. And especially, right, Gidon is basically, there are three chapters to the Gidon narrative. Chapter 6, which is what we call the call narrative. Chapter 6, that's where Gidon is charged with the mission to save Bnei Israel. Then you have chapter 7, which is the actual battle. That's where Gidon fights against Midian. And then you have chapter 8, which is where Gidon, you know, finishes the battle, kills the Midianite kings, and then comes back. So chapter 6, the chapter where Gidon is given his mission, has an amazing plethora of links to Moshe Rabbeinu. And you almost can't miss them. The verse themselves just bring up the Exodus again and again. But I'm scrolling down. If you have the screen share, you see it. If you have the document, you can look on your own on page 2. We have this section here, right, parallels in the call narrative, when both Moshe and Gidon are given their charge. And basically, everything is parallel, right? You begin with a description of the state of Bnei Yisrael at the time. They're under miserable oppression, and they cry out, right? Vayizaku. In Egypt, once again, by Yizaku, right? They're under oppression. They are crying out to Hashem. Same preamble. Then we shift the scene, right? And remember in the Chumash, so we cut scene from Hashem remembering Bnei Israel. Then we have Moshe, who's, you know, hanging out. He's having a regular day at work as a shepherd. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Vayirah Melat Malach Hashem Elav. Out of nowhere, right? He has this amazing prophetic vision. So Gidon, you have the exact same thing. He's got a regular day at work, right? He's threshing the grain. You know, he's doing it in the wine press because he's hiding out from the Midianites. And all of a sudden, he has, you know, he has an angelic appearance to him. Okay, so the preamble is the same.
the sudden appearance to the leader who was, you know, doing nothing, you know, having a regular day at work is the same. Then you get the mission,
and the mission is given with the same shoresh, each one of them. The Malach tells Moshe, Lecha b'shalachacha, right? Go and I'm going to send you. Those two words, which I put in red, are also used for Gidon. What's the response, right? What does Moshe respond when Hashem says, go to Egypt and save B'nai Israel? Moshe says, right? Any Monty Python fans in the audience will appreciate this one, right? I'm not worthy. Right, that's what Moshe responds. You know, you're asking me, I can't do it. I'm not right one for the job. And Gideon says the exact same thing. Right, Gideon's response is, I'm not worthy. You know, my family is the smallest one in the tribe. I'm the youngest one in my family. Of course, Moshe is also the youngest one in his family. Okay, so everything is tracking from Moshe to Gideon. Then what happens after Moshe tells Hashem, you know, I'm not going to do it. I can't do it. So Hashem says, no problem. I'll be with you. Right. I'm going to be with you. What does Hashem say to Gideon? I'll be with you. And then finally, you know, you have a sign, right? There's the request for the sign, the oath, and that is in the Gideon narrative as well. So the whole story of Gideon being charged with leadership parallels very dramatically the story of Moshe, right? When you are reading the election of Gideon as leader, you are supposed to be thinking about Moshe, which is the most, you know, if you had to have one leader that you're going to be compared to, you can't do much better than Moshe Rabbeinu. Not only that, but this is kind of cool, right? So that piece, I mean, it just jumps out. But there's something really interesting as well. What happens after Gideon is selected, right? He's supposed to lead in Israel. So he's told, right, he has to go, and his father is an idolatrous priest, which is also kind of similar to Moshe, right, whether it's Paro or Yisro, right, there's idolatry in the family. So he's supposed to go in the middle of the night and take the animal, which is supposed to be for idolatry, and shecht it as a karban, right, and destroy the idolatry that's around them. So it actually sounds an awful lot like the karban Pesach. There are some differences, but also some clear similarities. You have a carbon that's associated with night, right? You have the animal, which is associated with idolatry, which is instead being taken as a carbon, and the people around are horrified by this behavior. That's very carbon Pesach-esque. So then you have Gideon throughout chapter 6, both his selection as leader, echoing Moshe's selection as leader, and then what he's supposed to do afterwards sounds an awful lot like the Karban Pesach. Rashi, in a couple of places, also, you know, notes that Rashi says it seems like this whole thing happened on Pesach, right? And Rashi has two reasons why he thinks that this is happening on Pesach. Number one, because when Gideon feeds the angel, so he gives him matzah, right? So why is he giving him matzah? I mean, you know, so if it's not Pesach and someone offers you matzah, you're probably cranky, right? So he's giving him matzah because that's what he has available, right? That's Pesach. And also, on the line where Gideon says, you know, my father tells me about these miracles we have in Egypt. So Rashi says, yeah, last night, right? They had the Seder last night. Today is the 15th of Nisan. So Rashi's telling us it's Pesach. We have Mitzrayim in the text. We have matzah in the text. We have the call narrative, which is totally paralleling that of Moshe. We have the first thing afterwards, which sounds a lot like the Karban Pesach, and we could come up with a few more, but I think that you know does the job for now. We think of Gideon, and we're supposed to think of Moshe. Now, one very very important point is that, you know, as I say, lo lahagzim, right? Don't take this too far. The text does make sure to emphasize right from the get go that there is one fundamental difference between Moshe and Gideon, because in the aftermath of Gideon's vision, so he realizes that it was an angel that he was talking to, and he panics. He thinks he's going to die, and he says he thinks he's going to die because he says, "Ra'iti malach Hashem panim el panim." I've seen an angel of God face to face. I'm not able to do that, and therefore I should die. And then he gets another prophecy saying, "You know, don't worry, you're not going to die." But those words, panim el panim, what does that automatically make us, you know, what does that hyperlink us to immediately?
Moshe,
right? Face to face. And that came up at the end of the Chumash when the Torah said that there was never a prophet like Moshe who spoke with Hashem face to face. So Moshe's routine prophecy from day one till the end is he speaks to God himself face to face. And Gideon has this one prophecy with an angel, and he thinks he's going to die because he talked face to face to an angel. Right?
So even as we have all these comparisons between Moshe and Gideon, so the text is making sure that we take note, don't compare their level of prophecy. We want you to note the connection. We want you to compare the leadership of Moshe and Gideon. At the same time, you know, we're not dealing with the same caliber of prophet that we had with Moshe Rabbeinu.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I think it's altogether known that the time of the Shoftim, the Bnei Israel were in a much lower madrega, and that the whole era, that probably in the context of their time, they had a certain greatness.
Right.
So Moshe, in his time, everybody, although they were enslaved, but they had a higher level. I mean, the whole era of the Shoftim was full of this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. We're gonna come back. I think I mentioned something of that before, and we're going to come back to it at the end, is that it's always important to remember, because Shoftim focuses on the Shofet, but 100% we also have to be thinking, what is the state of the people, right? The book is really going to focus on that most at the end, when, you know, there are no leaders. But we need to be thinking about that 100%, and actually that's what the last source that I put on the sheet I want to focus on, right? What exactly is the state of the people? Okay. So we have these connections between Gideon and Moshe, which seem to be painting Moshe in as positive a Gideon in as positive a light as we could hope. If you were going to be compared to anyone, you'd want it to be Moshe. You move to chapter 7, right, which again describes the battle between Gideon and Midian. And you have amazing connections to another hero of the Chumash, right? The first great Jewish warrior, who we never really think of as a warrior, because we there's so much good stuff with Avraham that we skip over the war of the four kings and the five kings. But that's the first great, you know, Jewish battle. Avraham is really the first Jewish fighter. Gideon's battle and Avraham's battle have a number of links. The size of the army, right? So Gideon's army is reduced to 300 men. Avraham's army, the way the Chumash puts it, 18 u'shlosh meyot. Very, very similar army size, 318 versus 300. Not only that, but if you remember Rashi about Avraham's war, right? Was it 318 or was it just a two-man army, right? Because Eliezer in Gematria is 318. So Rashi has that line there that, you know, maybe it was just Avraham and Eliezer. You know, in the pshat, you'd say it's not just, you know, Moshe, Avraham, and Eliezer. Maybe it's the two of them playing the primary role and everyone else following from behind. But you have the phenomenon of the two-man army with Gideon as well, because before the rest of the soldiers, right, start the attack, you have Gideon and his own servant, Pura, who, you know, I guess did something to offend his parents. They gave him the name Pura. But you have those two, right, beginning the battle. So the army size is basically, you know, is very, very similar. Sadiev, is it 300? Is it two? Very similar. The military tactics. We have a vastly smaller army, Gideon's and Avraham's, taking on a huge enemy force. How do they do it? So, totally skip this over. The Chumash actually tells us what Avraham did. Right, you didn't just charge them in the middle of the open and a miracle happens and they run away. It's not the case. The pasuk tells us that Yechalek Alehem Laila, Avraham splits his army into groups at night, right? And then he surprises them with a night attack coming from all different directions. They panic and they run all the way, and then he chases them all the way out to Damascus. Gideon does the exact same thing. He splits his army into three groups and then they do a night attack. And then they're going to chase the enemy all the way out to the middle of nowhere in deep Jordan, as we'll see. So the tactics are the same. The army size is very similar. And one more point, you know, it hasn't been enough here to make you think of Avraham's war against the four kings when you read about Gideon's war against Midian, is what was Abraham's goal? Abraham is trying to save his brother. At least that's what the Chumash tells us. It's not actually his brother, right? It's his nephew. Lot is Avraham's nephew, but Avraham calls Lot his brother. Veshma Avraham ki nishba achiv. And he goes after to rescue his brother. Well, Avraham's not the only one who's fighting a war trying to rescue his brother, because we find out at the end of the war between Gideon and Midian, when he finally catches the enemy kings, that he's actually been hoping to find his brothers as well. His brothers went missing in action at Har Tavor. It's unclear what exactly was going on there, but he's apparently looking for them the whole battle. He finds finally finds the Midianite kings, and then they tell him, you know, that he was unsuccessful. They killed his brothers back before they lost the battle, which was a bad career decision for the Midianite kings, because Gideon tells them, you know, I would have let you live, but since you killed my brothers, that option is now off the table. So the war that Gideon has on a whole bunch of points is being compared to the war of Abraham. Now, what does that do? So we now have, right, if we just take stock, we have Gideon being compared to Moshe when he's chosen as leader. We have Gideon being compared to Abraham when he fights his battle. So those are pretty good people to be compared to. Now, what personality trait seems to jump out in each case? With Moshe, it's the personality trait of humility, right? Moshe, who's the humble, modest Moshe, doesn't want to take on the leadership role, and that seems to echo itself in Gideon. With Avraham, it's Avraham's faith, which seems to be the dominant attribute that Gideon is supposed to echo. And faith is something that he's having, right, when he's fighting this war against a much larger force. But looking at through the lens of Gideon's faith, I think actually gives us a very, very important insight that I want to take a couple of minutes to draw out. If we think about Gideon's career leading up to the battle in Midian, Gideon struggles with faith, right? His initial conversation with the Malach and then with Hashem, he asks/demands, right, what happened? Where were all the miracles that we were told about in Egypt, right? Gideon comes into the conversation associating faith with miracles. Then he asks for a sign, and again, he needs more and more signs, right? He demands miracles to give him faith. So he offers the meal, right? And it gets miraculously consumed with fire. You know, in Moshe's vision, you have the bush that should have burned, but didn't, right? And in Gideon's vision, there's, you know, a stone and food and drink, which never should have burned, but it does, right? That's not enough. He needs a miraculous sign with wool and dew. And then that's not enough. He needs a second miraculous sign with the wool and the dew. And then that's not enough. And, you know, he's still afraid. And Hashem said, okay, fine, right? Go down to the camp if you still don't have faith. He struggles with faith the entire time. What's really amazing is that seeing all these miracles, right? He gets multiple divine communications. He sees at least three different miracles leading up to the battle. If we read the Pesukim carefully, what actually gives him the faith to fight the war, which compares him to Avraham? So let's read it carefully. He shows up, right? I'm looking here at the source sheet, chapter 7, Pasuk Yud Gimel. So, Vayavog Gideon. So Gideon comes down to the camp, and then he sees there was someone telling a dream to his fellow. One Midianite soldier was telling another soldier what he saw in a dream. As people point out that Gideon realized that the Midianite military preparedness was not what it should be, because the watchmen are literally sleeping on the job, right? You know, they wake up from their watch and they're telling each other, oh, here's what I just had dreamed about, right? So that's fine. Okay. Chalom chalamti, I had a dream. So he dreamed, I saw a cake of barley bread that rolled into the camp of Midian, and it smote the tent, and it turned us upside down. And his fellow says to him, Ein zo pilti im cherev gedon ben yoashish Yisrael. Surely that vision you had, that dream you had of the barley bread striking the tent and collapsing it, that was the sword of Gidon and Natan Elokim biyado et Midyan ve'et kol ha'machaneh. God has given our camp into Gidon's hand. Right? He sees a dream. One soldier tells another, we're done. We're done. The dream means that Hashem is giving Gidon is giving Midyan to Gidon. And then the Navi says, Ahikashma Gidon and Misapera Chalon. When Gidon heard about the dream, Bet Shivro and the meaning, Vayishtachu, he bowed, Vayashal Machane Israel. He goes back to the camp. And he says, get up, right, let's go to war. Kinatan Hashem Yerchem Machane Midyan. Hashem has given you the victory. So let's just think about this for 1 second. He sees three miracles and he has like seven different prophecies. Why is it that a dream from a couple of Midianite soldiers is all of a sudden the tipping point that gives him the faith to attack? Right? And it's not like Yosef is the one interpreting the dream over here. Right? It's like a couple of privates in the army who, you know, are from Midian. He hears them have a dream and bang, now he has the faith. What?
It's like the story of Yoshua and Rahav.
What do you mean?
In Rahav, that she said, everybody's afraid of your conquest. So he's looking for a similar sign.
I guess, but you know, it's not like Yehoshua had a crisis of faith with, you know, miracle after miracle coming and it doesn't do the job for him. And now, you know, the two spies come to Rahav and, like, you know, he sees the light, right? What's the difference between a dream and everything else that has happened until now? What is the difference here that gives him the faith that nothing else could have done before? So I think the answer is really very simple, is that what makes Gidon able to believe is when he sees other people have faith that this is going to be the case.
That's the Rahab story also. That's the analogy.
I guess. But right, again, I mean, the difference is that it's not like Yehoshua didn't have faith leading up to the Rahab story, right? I mean, it was like, you know, look, part of the problem of the Rahab story is why do they have to send spies into Yericho in the first place, right? That's really not so clear.
Right.
He has so many miracles and prophecies. As long as he is by himself, he's not able to muster the faith, right? And that's maybe one key difference, and that kind of highlights the greatness of Avraham. Because Avram really is a one-person thing, right? He goes from nothing to full faith. Gidon is not able to get there by himself. But once he sees, right, that there are other people who believe this is going to happen, other people have faith that this is possible, that is what unlocks it for him. So he musters the faith that Avraham had. But we shouldn't think of miracles as a panacea, right? And that might be like part of the point of the whole story. In the book of Shoftim, where we're struggling to come to grips with how to have faith in a time where miracles are going away. So part of the message of Gidon is, hey, we're going to have a comparison to the faith of Abraham, but that's actually not going to come from seeing miracles. If you see miracles, it's overrated how much of an impact that has. I'm not sure why that's true because I've never seen miracles, but that's what the Navi is saying. The key to faith is being among those who are able to have faith by themselves. And if you have a faith community, that then can multiply its dividends. If you're among those who have
faith. That doesn't make for a leader.
No,
makes for a follower.
So that goes back to Ellie's question from the beginning. How important is the role of the leader and how important is the role of the people? Right? And I think 100% that some of what is coming out of Gidon is do not put everything on leadership, right? Leadership has to come from a community. And if the community is succeeding, then leadership has a chance. And if the community is failing, then leadership won't, right? That's what the Gemara was getting at when I talked about Yiftach Bedoro Kishmuel Bedoro, right? In a lot of ways, the generation is only as good as the leaders that it produces. Right, the leaders, the people can't say it's not our problem because, you know, these are the leaders we have. It's also on the people to produce the leadership. So that's Gidon compared to Moshe, compared to Avraham, right? The faith of Avraham, even though it's hard for him to come by, the humility of Moshe. Okay. Now we get to the end of the Gidon narrative, and things get very complicated. And it seems like the Gidon has a tragic flaw which rears its head, which is Gidon seems to present a bit of an ego. Now, this is something that is inevitable almost always in leadership, because how do you have a successful, charismatic leader who also doesn't have immense self-confidence? And let's be clear, Gidon is extremely successful and extremely charismatic. I put the map on here to give a sense of what he's able to do. He gets his army of 300 men, because by the end they're back to only 300 men, to look how far they go in chasing the Midianite enemy, who imagines that they were totally safe all the way out here. The original battle is here. They then run out way into the middle of the desert. This is far beyond where any other Jewish army is going to fight in the Tanakh, to the best of my knowledge. They are not going to go, even maybe David going up north, but even that I think is pushing it, how far Gidon leads his little band of troops. He's a charismatic leader, and that's essential to his success. He's also one who's able to put his ego down. He has this moment of potential civil war with Ephraim, and he just, you know, totally flatters them and talks humbly about himself and successfully averts civil war. Something that next week, remember about Yiftach, we're going to see Yiftach totally fails to do. But we get to the end of Gidon's story, and we see just a real negative pattern appear. Gidon is taking trophies for himself, and then Gidon asks the people, give me all your golden rings that we got in the conquest, and is going to make an ephod. It's unclear what this ephod is. I saw some people from Haaretzion, which I think makes the most sense, arguing it doesn't make any sense that the ephod was an idol. Like, it's just impossible to believe. But the ephod was a sort of monument to the victory. It's like a heroic monument, you know, documenting Gidon's great moment. But we can't miss the connection between Gidon asking the people to pool their gold and make a golden statue to the story of the golden calf, right? So you have the person who is compared to Moshe, and to Moshe's humility at the end is, you know, creating something which is compared to a golden calf, seemingly because of his need to celebrate and create a monument to his own victory. Let's also remember, right, how did Avraham's battle against the four kings and the five kings end? Right, it ended with him going back to Sodom, and the king of Sodom says, you know, you take the property and give me the people. And Avraham says, I'm not going to take a string, and I'm not going to take a bootlace. Right, Avraham insists on not taking any of the captured booty for himself. And then you have the Gidon story, which ends with a real problem coming out of the booty that Gidon takes to make this this monument. So you have the two leaders that Gidon is compared to in the first parts of the story. And then the closing moment is one that shows how Gidon comes up short, right? Unlike Moshe, he's taking gold and building a monument. So the humility is kind of out the window. And unlike Avraham, he's not disavowing himself of the fruits of victory. He's asking for them to build this golden statue. Gidon is asked by Bnei Israel to be their king. And he has a very firm response. He says, I'm not your king. You know, God is your king. And that's wonderful. That's exactly what Shmuel tells the people should have been their attitude a couple of centuries after this. And yet, if we think about Gidon's behavior, so we're told that Gidon had 70 sons because he had many wives, and he has a Pelegesh. So he's basically acting like a king. He's someone who wants the perks of kingship, the gold, all the wives, which, by the way, Torah says a Jewish king is not supposed to have a lot of gold, and a Jewish king is not supposed to have a lot of wives, right? But he wants the fruits of victory without maybe the responsibilities of leadership. So then we have in Gidon someone who has a lot to be inspired by, someone who is a much more, you know, normal person as it was, right? Who's dealing with a world where he doesn't grow up seeing open miracles. And he comes into this world wondering, they tell me about Yetziat Mitzrayim, and I don't see anything like that. And he manages to come to faith, right, in an era where that is much more difficult. He's compared to Moshe, he's compared to Avraham. Yet at the end, right, the story really closes by emphasizing for us, you know, that ultimately he doesn't reach that level, right? He is not in the level A all-time, you know, Hall of Fame Jewish leadership group. And leadership is really hard, right? It's really hard. There's responsibility. There's to balancing the charisma with the ego, right? Balancing the work he has to put in with the desire for the perks that he wants. And that's ultimately where Gidon comes up short. Now, a couple minutes left. So I'm not going to go into the Avimelech story in depth, right? Avimelech, let's also note that what's Avimelech's name? My father is a king, right? So did Gidon give Avimelech that name, or did Avimelech take that name for himself? But Avimelech, I said, failure looks canonic, because in Avimelech, we see something really amazing. The Dat Mikra commentary notes about Avimelech. So the whole story is about Avimelech and the people of Shechem. So the Dat Mikra commentary notes that these people seem like they're not Jewish. Rashi actually talks about this as well. It seems like the people here in Shechem are still Canaanites. You see that, for example, because the Navi tells us that they come to their temples. So like, what's going on in their temples? And then the Navi also tells us about this person, Gaal, who says, you know, we're the citizens of Hamor and Shechem, you know, the Canaanite ruler back from Sefer Bereishis. So Shechem seems like it was one of those Canaanite cities that was never really rooted out, right? That remains, you know, it comes to some sort of peace treaty with the people, but it's still there. And you see the corrosive effect that they have. How does Avimelech end up? Avimelech ends up as king of Shechem, right? He's king. He's king of this, you know, little area. That should sound familiar to us after having learned Sefer Yehoshua, because what was the Canaanite government structure when Yehoshua got there? It was a bunch of petty kingdoms, right? A bunch of petty kings. So Avimelech, the son of Gidon, right, the greatest and most accomplished of the judges, Avimelech ends up being a Canaanite king. What a way to encapsulate what's going to be the collapse and fall of Bnei Yisrael. And we get to the end of the book, this is really going to jump out. But now we're seeing, you know, Avimelech is like a foretaste of what's going to come down the road, is we have this transformation, everything Yehoshua accomplishes being undone, and Bnei Yisrael are just turning into Canaanim. Oh my gosh, what's Yael Ziegler from Alon Shvut, right? So she has this book on Megillat Rut, which is amazing. So she points out, additionally, you know, besides the phenomenon of Bnei Yisrael kind of transforming into Canaan over the course of Shoftim, there's also an evolution from being the sons of Avraham to behaving like Lot. So that's going to come up, for example, you know, when Yiftach is going to be willing to sacrifice his daughter, right? That's going to be Lot behavior. The whole Sodom parallel we're going to have at the end of Shoftim, that's going to be Lot behavior. The abandoning of Chesed, you could possibly argue Shimshon's promiscuity is going to be Lot behavior. And then, right, her argument in her book is that Rut is supposed to come along, right? And she, even though she's dependent of Lot, right, she's a Moabite, right, she's supposed to bring Chesed and all the Avraham values back to Bnei Yisrael, right? So that's going to redeem the period of the Shoftim. But the idea that Bnei Yisrael over the course of Shoftim are losing their Avraham behavior and they're becoming Canaanim, they're becoming, you know, Lot descendants. So we see that with Avimelech very quickly. And just, you know, one last thing: if you have the source sheet, you can look on your own. I made a list. There are at least 16 ways. Avimelech and Gidon are set up as opposites. So many ways. Okay, take a look on your own. You'll see.
Where is the source sheet? Did you send that out?
Is this PDF?
There's a PDF. It should. I sent it to. You know, I'll send it through chat. I'll send it through chat as you have it on your own. I thought it had been emailed out. Avimelech is Gidon's opposite. So even as Gidon is being, you know, he's compared to Moshe and Avraham, but he's not quite at their level. At the same time, every leader who is going to come after Gidon is going to be compared to him and is going to come up short. Avimelech, that's like super clear. We'll learn about Yiftach next week. And have Gidon in your mind when you learn about Yiftach, and you'll see the Navi is comparing them as well. And once again, someone who doesn't make the cut. With Shimshon, there are pieces. And then Shaul and Yehonatan, it gets very clear again. Shaul is really compared to Gidon, right? Another person who quasi-king, but comes up short of what Gidon is able to accomplish. And then the very last point to close on Gidon's career, because that's like how the Navi closes it out, is when the Navi sums up the failure of Bnei Yisrael after Gidon dies. So the Navi says in verse 34, so Bnei Yisrael did not remember Hashem, right? Okay, so that's like, you know, that's what we're used to. Then the Navi says, the lo asu chesed im beit Yerubbaal Gidon kechol atava asher asam Yisrael. The people did not do chesed with Gidon. So, I mean, what is that supposed to make us think, right? We have the leader who is compared to Avraham, right? Doesn't get all the way there, but gets close. And then the people do not follow in Avraham's path, right? They don't do chesed with Gidon. Chesed is abandoned, and instead we have all the behavior of Avimelech, which is going to be theft, and murder, and massacring civilians, and just, you know, general total disaster. So that's why I think Gidon really does, you know, sum up, he serves as a perfect turning point in Sefer Shoftim. He's a very human leader. He's a flawed leader. He's a struggling leader. At the same time, he's one who's able to have real successes, and some even tremendous successes, which everyone else coming after him is going to be in his shadow. Yiftach and Shaul are going to be comparing themselves to Gidon. And then ultimately the aftermath is that the people aren't there. The people are not following in Avraham's path. They are not doing chesed. And what we're going to be left with is a disaster is coming down the road of Avimelech and the statue of Micha and finally Pelegesh Begiva. And so that's all the wonderful things we have to look forward to in the next couple weeks.
But isn't this exactly what Hashem said to get rid of Canaan? And they didn't. So they assimilated and they took on a lot of their attributes.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. This is exactly what
I have a question about Gidon. It sounds like he was very insecure. He needed to hear it from the enemy that he was great and that there were miracles, and later on he needs statues to confirm how great he is. He sounds like a very insecure person.
It could be. On the other hand, we'll contrast next week the behavior of Gidon and Yiftach when they deal with the tribe of Ephraim, because the tribe of Ephraim, you know, kind of complains, and Yiftach behaves very insecurely and starts a civil war. And Gidon says to them, you know, you guys are amazing. You did amazing victories. I'm nothing. You're amazing. And he manages to totally win them over by just, you know, putting down his own ego. So he's complicated, right? He's complicated, Gidon. But I think the technique of comparisons and contrasts really helps, sharpen those complications. And also, especially with the people, the judges after him, shows that at the end of the day, he really does belong in the group of the greats and not in the group of the failures who come after. Okay. Any other questions?
It just seems to me that one of the comparisons that you don't make is with Shlomo. He shares some of, you know, the wives and the monument and all that. He shares some of the attributes with Shlomo, who is later, but
and also a complicated, but I think ultimately positive person, but not.
But filled with flaws.
Exactly.
I have a little broader question, something I'm trying to figure out. So yeah. we have Yeshua, who is in a class by himself and is really in great balance with the Almighty, no issues. And he is told that they have to come in and clean out the country, take it all over, and it's going to take a long time. And he does everything he's supposed to, including get a lot of help. But they leave a lot of tribes. And he sort of like leaves it alone. I mean, he's in the central part, defeating some of the small kings. Yehuda is in the south, doing his thing. And they completely did not finish the mission, which is what created all of these other problems. Because the Canaanim were there and they were easy to start copying and joining and intermarrying and all that. And it's hard. I understand how all these other people who are not perfect and really didn't measure up to what we consider our great heroes. But Yehoshua was right there. He was right there. What happened?
So I think the way to evaluate Yehoshua is Yehoshua destroys the Canaanim as a strategic threat. Right, there is no strategic threat from Canaan, and that is Yehoshua's victory. What he leaves them with is the need to do a lot of mop-up work. Right, so they're not facing an enemy that can destroy them or even threaten them anymore. Right, that's Yehoshua's great accomplishment, and that's his conquest. They now have conquered the land. There is no one in the land who threatens them when Yehoshua finishes. What he leaves them that they still have to do is the mop-up and the clear out, right? And which on paper should have been the easier part to do, right? And they just don't come through because they'd rather, you know, tax them and make some money, as the book of Shemot says in the beginning. Yeah. For some reason, I can't see anybody. So
we're here.
Your source sheet is still up. Perhaps that's why.
Your screen.
Yeah, I'll try to stop share. Okay.
Oh, now you can see us all.
Oh, okay. Oh, this is it was so weird. Okay, this is such a weird.
I think
everybody.
Rabbi, I think the lineage issues is a tip off.
The what issue, Bernie?
The lineage issues is a tip off because Abimelech was the son of a concubine,
right?
And Yiftach was the son of the Zonah. So I think that's part of it's a symbol of the poor transition here.
For sure. Yeah. And then something to also think about as we get to, by the way, in the coming, because stuff's going to get really depressing in the coming Prakim, right? So one thing to think ahead to is how Shmuel is going to serve as the real redeemer of all this, right? On so many different levels. Right, Bernie, you're talking about the importance of parentage, right? So we contrast, you know, Avimelech's parentage or Yiftach's parentage with, there's a reason why the book of Shmuel begins with Chana, right? Book of Shmuel doesn't begin with Shmuel, book of Shmuel begins with Chana, right? It's for a reason. He's from the tribe of Levi, right? Shmuel is going to do a lot. And he's the one who's also going to be compared to Moshe, but he actually like pulls it off, right? He doesn't fall short. At the end, so you know we're gonna have a lot of depressing stuff coming down the road. So you know as we learn that, let's you know keep in mind that that Shmuel, you know, Shmuel is gonna be the one to you know we have Rus from you know Megillah from a couple weeks ago, right? Okay. She's like you know on the parallel track, right? As the Jews are collapsing, you know we have Rus in Moab who's here to save the day, and then we have Shmuel coming down the road. So yeah. It's gonna get really bad.
That's right.
Important to remember the good stuff. All right. So, shkach, everyone.
Good night.
Shkach to you.
Fabulous.
Thank you very much.
Good night. Good night.
Shkach. Thank you very much.
I sent you a text.
Okay, yeah, let me I'll take a look at it now, honey. Allie, 1 second. Oh, okay, great.
Thank you.
All right, Tom.